Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. And we want to spend the last part of the show today with another installment of our series, Uncomfortable Truths Confronting Race in America. We've been running this series for several months now and asking you to nominate yourselves to take part in some difficult but honest discussions about race. Rochelle Shimke heard that call out on the air and she wrote to us. Rochelle grew up in the 60s on a farm in a very small white community in Tacoma, Washington. Her parents are white, like Rochelle, but she has two adopted brothers, Norton, who was adopted from South Korea, and her brother Garrett, who is black. Rochelle wrote to us, "I would love to have a conversation with my brother about how we both grew up in the same land, but maybe saw completely different landscapes." So we invited Rochelle and Garrett to sit down and talk about their upbringing and how it's informed the way they perceive race in America today.
I have to confess that I did not see our family as different until just recently. I guess I had never thought of my brothers as a different color.
Yeah, same here. I mean, within a, what I would always exaggerate and say, within a 100-mile radius, Norton and I were it for everybody. There wasn't Latin or Asian or anything else. It was just us and everyone else. However, that was for me. I can only speak for myself, not Norton. My norm. So even though I could look and see that I was with a family of blonde hair, blue eyed, 8 foot tall people, that was my normal. So I didn't grow up seeing that as meaning that I was different from them. It wasn't until I was old enough for people to see and say, "Hey, how come you don't look like your parents?" From which then I took a leaf out of my dad's book and would make up an embellished story and say, "Well, back in the day, you know, the slave trade, it's a recessive gene," and I just kind of popped out. I mean, wow. I would say things like that because I'm politically very incorrect. Yeah, I told my friends that. I said, it just came out. And dad was behind me once when I told somebody that, and he gave me a little high five because it's like, way to go, son.
Dude, I never heard that. So when do you think, Garrett, that you realized that you and Norton and all of us were all different colors?
Well, it's kind of like I knew, but that didn't register as being anything but normal. It wasn't till I didn't see that it was not normal until probably junior high when now we're out of the rural area. We're into school with more observers, so to speak, that can comment and notice that we're so different.
At Keithley Junior High.
Yeah. And that's what I think is so incredible is by all statistics, I should have had a really tough time in a rural farming community as the only black child for miles in the 60s, but I didn't feel that. And even to people then, if I were to ever say, "I am a black child," which isn't bad, but is kind of a comment of separation, like, "I am black," meaning I'm different than you, that would have probably struck them as a little strange, like, "Well, I didn't know that," because people just saw you, me, as part of the community.
Right.
And there were occasions when we went into really small restaurants in the rural towns, and I could tell everyone sort of turned their heads and looked, and I thought, well, maybe it's because of me. But the thing about that is I never let that own my definition.
Okay.
I knew why they were possibly staring, but I didn't go into places thinking they're going to stare, they're going to hate, they're going to treat me differently.
Oh, God.
I recognized when it happened, I never really had any confrontations growing up, racially speaking. Really, the only confrontations I ever had with anyone was always people who looked like me because I was different from them. Possibly the way that I talked or the fact that I played banjo and like bluegrass music and were doing things that stereotypically weren't black enough.
Wow.
But from white people growing up in this rural farm town where I should have probably most likely have had that experience, I didn't have that.
So moving forward, like by 20, 30 years. So you and I got to hang out when you became a cosmetologist and you had your salon in Bellevue. I was shocked to hear during one of our chats about how what you just mentioned, that you felt racism from black people to you and not in King County from white people to you.
Yeah, that's the part that I want to tread lightly on. It is uncomfortable.
Oh, okay.
But that's the type of racism that I've always received, is that I don't come across black enough, whatever that is.
Wow.
That, and then the other one saying, you're the whitest black man that I've ever met. I get that all the time.
Dang.
And it's a shame that if you speak like I do, whatever that is, mm-hmm. if you listen to music that is outside of the urban or rap or what have you, that somehow that means you're not something, rather than you're taking the opportunity to think, I'm an American, mm-hmm. so all these music types, all these cultures, all these things belong to all of us. Mm-hmm. So why not open your box more? Grab as much as you can, rather than live in this small box that says you can only do these certain things, or otherwise you're not representing your people well enough. And that's in all cultures, I think, to some degree.
You have white women that used to come to your salon. And I think I asked you once why you never had women of color or black women in your salon. Do you remember that conversation? Do you remember that question?
Oh, no.
So, and your response to me was?
Okay. So, for one, I did grow up in a white family, partially Korean. My hair was straight growing up, so I only had experience with that. And black hair is something culturally that typically you have your black salons, because there's a lot more to the whole process, which I don't know myself, because I went to a beauty school, which some would call a white beauty school, where you have 30 seconds with a mannequin with Afro black hair, and someone's picking it out going, all right, you just got to pick it out a little bit, and then there's more education that needs to be known about doing black hair. So people would see me cutting hair in the salon and assume, oh, he's an expert, I'm going to ask for him. Because the question a lot of black women will ask when they go to a salon that they don't know or haven't gone to is, do they know how to do black hair? That is a very common question, because you do need to know. It's different than everyone else's.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't taught that. I didn't grow up with it. Then the look of disappointment and disgust at me is, how could you be a black man and not know how to do your own people's hair? And that's very hard to have that conversation and to have to admit that. But on the other side, why do you assume that the white woman next to me doesn't know how to do your hair? She happens to be the expert in this whole salon.
Right.
She puts in a lot of time. She went to a school that taught her. You're assuming she doesn't, and you're assuming I do. That's a double racist assumption in that part. But no one ever calls that out.
We just heard how Garrett never really considered himself to be a minority. He felt like he was part of the family and the larger community. But when he left that community and went just a few miles south to Cedro Woolley, all of a sudden he wasn't one of the Shimkey kids. He was black.
So Cedro Woolley is a little small town, as both of us know, kind of rural, just like more or less where we grew up on 32nd Avenue. And people have always been really friendly, maybe because it's also a farming town or rural town. That is not the experience that you have. And when you shared your story, I was sick to my stomach, So can you please share again what happened with you going through Cedro Woolley?
So Tiff and I used to live in Bellingham.
Right, okay.
And in the month of August, I would ride my bike from Bellingham to Seattle or Bellingham to Bellevue or reverse, just to give myself a little challenge on a bike.
Okay.
And every time, strangely enough, and see, and I don't go into places looking for this or expecting this, so that's why this is so different from anything else I've ever encountered in my life. The minute I crossed into the border of Cedro Woolley on either side, either going to the south end or coming from the south end to the north, there was a truckload of white kids that just found me and would drive by, pass me, and then yell out the window the N-word, and then just keep going.
God.
So it happened three times, and so finally I came with another route that went around Chuckanut Drive the long way around, because they didn't want to go through Cedro Woolley. It was a little odd. It's almost like they were waiting there for somebody different to come through and do it. Now, I don't know if that represents, and I doubt it does, all of Cedro Woolley. It just happened to be along Highway 9 that coming in and out these groups of kids saw me and chased me down in a truck.
Damn. Yeah. Damn.
Yeah, but I honestly don't care, because as long as it doesn't hurt me and they go on their way, it is just them screaming out a window. It's unsettling. But in the end, if that's all they have in them and that's all they're going to do, I don't need to change them as long as I get from point A to B unharmed.
It's horrifying for me that my beautiful brother, who I love with my life and with my heart, has been treated in horrible racist fashions that I had no idea was going on.
But see, if you think of it this way, I mean, and I appreciate that, but considering how great of a life I had, if I had to do it all over again, I would choose the exact same path. Growing up in Tacoma, Puyallup, in a rural town with the community from which we lived, it was fantastic because most of all, it allowed me to be my own person. Sure, there might have been a few instances where that kind of thing happened, but really not until I was an adult. So I had a pretty safeguarded experience. Sure, people may have stared at me sometimes who had never seen a brown boy walking around, but that doesn't break me. And we all have struggles of our own, correct?
But it's the greater
of it all. And that is, I grew up an individual, a supported individual, in a beautiful community. I don't care about any of that other stuff. I'm not suffering. Sure, a truckload scared me and they yelled out the N-word, but it doesn't devalue who I am in my own mind. As long as I'm not destroyed or hurt, it really isn't a, wow, he really struggled. Here's a little funny story.
Okay.
And of course, with the way that I think, only this would happen to me with my naivety. Did you ever realize that I inadvertently dressed up as a Klan member for Halloween?
No.
Do you remember when I used to dress up as a ghost? I always wanted to be a ghost, but I always wanted the top to be pointy. And not until I was an adult did I realize, oh my gosh, I was a Klan member. A black Klan member. Just get a sheet and cut two holes and off you go. Yeah.
That is
I just discovered
right?
that years ago. And
really?
Thought, oh, wow. I had no idea what I was doing. Yeah. It was innocent.
Innocent.
Yeah.
Our whole life was so innocent.
It was. You're just not aware.
No, and I'm not.
That's the question I bring to the listeners is my unawareness of those kind of issues. And I grew up happy. Because I wasn't looking for those kind of things. I wasn't thinking of myself as a victim. I wasn't looking to be mistreated. So therefore, I wasn't, even if I was. So what is the harm of that, as opposed to having to prove and find every racist person out there and go up to their face and say, you're a racist and you're mistreating me and you're doing this? I feel great. And I may have missed opportunities to do that if somebody was treating me in a way, just because I'm black, but the fact that I didn't know, didn't care, and went about my business doesn't make me less of a person. I always knew who I was. So why can't that be more of the trend, as opposed to always going up and pointing fingers at people and just calling everybody in the world a racist for everything?
Garrett, I wish now in this last couple of years with the person that is in the White House we have now, and all the things that have come surfaced, as they say, and the attacks, knife attacks on a Muslim woman, and the killing of the man in Kent who happened to be Sikh, and it just makes me ill what's happening with racism now at the surface, and the things that white people are doing against others who don't look like them. I'm pleased to my heart that you did not grow up that way, that we were not treated by any KKK members or anyone in our towns coming at us just because we all happen to look different from one another.
It didn't happen that way. You're right. We didn't have that. But I think that no one's exempt. I think it comes from both ends. We're just putting in the news the white to black end, though. I mean, we're making it so impossible to relate interracially because there's all these terms we have to know. all these identifications, right. all these politically correct things that if you don't match the exact term that that one individual wants to be called, whether it be black, colored, African-American, or what have you, then you're a racist. So I don't even think we really know what that word means anymore. I mean, it was bad then, and it's now bad the other way now, I think. We need to come back in the middle, and I don't know if that ever will again.
We want to thank Garrett Shimke and his sister, Rochelle Shimke, for sharing their story with us. Well, as we've heard in this conversation and others here on The Takeaway, interracial adoption can be complicated. In a few days, we'll talk with Rebecca Carroll. She's special projects editor at WNYC. And Rebecca will share her story of being adopted by white parents and why she believes race is vital to talk about in these families. Again, that conversation is coming up later this week. And of course, we always want to hear from you. Some of these conversations in our Uncomfortable Truth series are tough, and that's the point. If you agree or disagree, or it made you think or made you want to scream at your radio, let us know. You can always call us at 8778-MY-TAKE. Tomorrow on the show, we'll bring you a roundup of some of our Uncomfortable Truths conversations, and we want you to take part. Visit thetakeaway.org/truths. Tell us how you could bridge racial divides in your world by having a conversation with anyone of your choosing. It could be a family member, a friend, or a coworker. We'll review that submission, and if we select your story, we'll set up everything to record your conversation. Again, visit us at thetakeaway.org/truths to sign up. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.